Welcome back to The Bonfire, where we talk about UFC and mixed martial arts. I am your host, Mike Bon, and I must say, folks, it is good to be home. I've taken a few days to rest up after essentially 22 straight days on the road from Saudi Arabia to Abu Dhabi to Edmonton, all of which we did podcasts from. I appreciate everyone following along on that mini journey we had, but now we are home, we are rested, we are energized, and that is a good thing because today's episode is a celebration. A celebration of what, you may ask? What bigger than what goes down Saturday? It is known to some as UFC Fight Night 247, but to others, it is the long-awaited, highly anticipated UFC Vegas 100 hashtag show. It is the 100th event in the series of Fight Night cards with the UFC Vegas hashtag. This one headlined by a welterweight fight between Neil Magny and Carlos Prochaska. We're not going to break down the card itself per se, but rather the history leading up to it. UFC commentator Brendan Fitzgerald joins the show for the first time to recap some of the biggest moments, fights, calls, all that stuff that have happened at the UFC Vegas series, the majority of which Fitzy has been on the call for. So who better to get insights on what this piece of UFC history has been like, for better or worse? I know a lot of mixed feelings and thoughts on the UFC Apex at this point, but no doubt since COVID-19 hit, this has been an instrumental part of the UFC's operation, and Fitzgerald has been there for the overwhelming majority of those fights. So great insights from him and a great conversation to be had here coming up. Before we get there, if you could please remember to like, subscribe, follow, comment, or any other show of support on whichever audio or video platform you are consuming this on. As I always say, means the world to me as we try to build momentum behind this podcast. So please do that. And then, of course, after a quick break, enjoy the show. And we're back now joining the Bonfire for the very first time. It is one of the voices of the UFC, Mr. Brendan Fitzgerald, head of UFC Vegas 100. Brendan, it's a celebration. How are you doing?
Yes, it is. 100 and many others.
Yeah,
thanks
no kidding.
Thanks for having me on, Mike. Good to chat with you.
Yeah, thank you for doing this, man. I appreciate it. As I kind of said in the intro, we'll be going over some of our favorite moments from the UFC Vegas series. And I know we had talked about it a little bit last week when I kind of told you I wanted you on. We were trying to figure out how many of these shows you had done. I tried doing a little bit of counting. It's somewhere over 50, probably somewhere a little lower than 70. But man, you've done a lot of these shows. Do you know exactly how many, or is it lost in the sauce at this point?
I don't. It's totally lost. Between 50 and 70 sounds about right. I would probably put it between 60 and 70 if I had to guess. But yeah, it's been a familiar building. And on we go. You know, it's going nowhere. But this is the last one of the year. It's the 100th. Now, it's more than 100 Apex shows, right? Because pay-per-views were there. And then the Virgin Las Vegas Theater, I think that counted as a UFC Vegas too. So obviously the numbers are a little murky, but we're celebrating it this weekend. Hashtag UFC Vegas 100. Here we go.
Yeah, the numbers a little fudge. The official 100th event at the Apex was the ESPN Perez versus Tyra card that happened on
the
15th. That was the actual 100th event. But yeah, like in the series with the hashtag and everything, felt appropriate time, as you said, last one of the
year. Here we go.
Do you have like a routine for the Apex that you go into? Like, is it just like a very familiar scenario, obviously.
So it's familiar, but it's evolved. My routine has just changed based on like life. I mean, how much does life change over the course of 4 years? You know what I mean? And at the beginning, there was a pretty strict routine because of the pandemic. So we had to spend the night at a Marriott Courtyard in Las Vegas, even though I lived here, had to go the night before, just like a road show, and be in a hotel the night before. And then, you know, go to the Apex, and it felt more like a travel show in those days, albeit when you showed up on the other end, there was no crowd, right? Just bare minimum of people. And then, you know, 2022, we had our second baby. And so all of a sudden it's like, okay, you know, throw the cards up in the air again and let them settle where they may. So I think for the first half of the run in the Apex, I was really struggling with finding that routine and like coming to terms with it. It's not going to feel like a road show. It's not going to feel like an arena show at all. And so treat it differently, but at the same time, treat it with as much respect as you would an arena road show that's maybe got more people in the crowd and maybe more people watching on TV. And so now, earlier this year, I kind of just came to terms with it in a much healthier way, where I'm just like, just enjoy the heck out of out of it. You know, everybody's still watching on TV the same way that they would. Product looks a little bit different than it does pre-pandemic, but it's still a great product and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Have you noticed, obviously there has been an evolution in the environment, like very early on, no one could be in there. I remember we'll get into with one of my talking points, like deep in COVID, how barely anyone was let in there. You kind of alluded, you had to stay overnight in a hotel and be double tested and stuff. And now like family members are more welcome than they were before. They try to, you know, sell some of these VIP tickets. Have you noticed at least from within what the Apex can be, there is a change and an uptick in like energy and environment and stuff?
Yeah, it's on an event to event basis in terms of the environment that's inside. Sometimes it's actually like you look around, you're like, this is pretty good vibes here. Like this is like this crowd is into it. And then other times you're just like, man, like that was a great round. Why is nobody clapping in between the first and second round? Where because at the end of a round, the biggest difference from an arena show to an Apex show, I mean, among the bigger differences is at the end of a great round in an arena, the crowd kind of rises, right? And then there's that pop. Now they settle down usually before the start of the next round, but they kind of rise and let the fighters know how much they appreciate what they just saw. Whereas at the Apex, you'll get a bananas round sometimes. I remember Alex Caceres fought, I think it was Daniel Pineda, and they just had like a scrap in the first round. It was crazy. It was back and forth. It was an epic round. And then as soon as the horn goes, people just kind of quiet down. We go to break. And I'm like, what? You know, like clap for this a little bit. And then, so it takes like every round to build and it takes every fight to build. There's not a lot of carryover from fight to fight in the Apex as there is in an arena show. So that's like a big difference. But when we have the Vanderbilt baseball team in here, those are my favorite nights. Lawrence Epstein went to Vanderbilt, proud Vandy alum, and he's connected with their baseball coach. And so they've been in the Apex two different times. And each time I'm like, this is awesome. I wish you guys could come every weekend. I've went over there and told them that each time. So the Vanderbilt baseball team and Calvin Kattar fights. Kattar's crew, they travel, man. They travel and they buy tickets and they make it loud. So those are the specific ones.
Yeah, those Boston folks that make themselves known. All right, well, that's a perfect segue kind of into what I wanted to talk to you about. And it's kind of just like a recap of some memories from, you know, all these years, all these events. I kind of gave you like a blank criteria. It could be a fight, a moment, something personal that happened behind the scenes, whatever kind of stood out to you. I got my list. I'm sure you wrote some down as well. So I'll give you the floor first. It doesn't need to be like, you know, standout one at the top, whatever direction you want to go. So where do you want to start?
Yeah. Going? You know, these will come to me as I like think about the different events too, because it's so tough to keep track of them. And something I remember in around probably 2022 was like, oh yeah, that Derek Lewis fight happened 3 months ago, right? And it was a year ago or something or longer, right? So time just kind of warps when you're there, when you have all these events. But I'll just start with the Calvin Kattar Giga Chikadze fight, because just talked about how epic Calvin Kattar fans are and all the fun that it was. And that was Calvin's return. It was in a main event. Giga Chikadze was on like a nice run. And that was the first event of the year after, I think, 3 full weeks off, maybe even 4 weeks off. I can't remember exactly how many. But point is, it was like the first event of the season. Now that we have this ESPN deal, we kind of have that stop down over the holidays. So, you know, I think it was round two that things really started, you know, heating up in that fight. And at the end of the round, I delivered the call and I said, this has been missing in my life. And I got a lot of feedback from that, from fans who are just like, that's exactly what I was thinking. Been a month without fights. And then to have this main event to return to, and like, oh, it just felt like so natural to say that as a fan. So that's what I'll start with, is the Calvin Kattar Giga Chikadze epic fight. Kattar wins, I think, by unanimous decision over 5 rounds.
It's awesome. That's a great one for sure. And I think it leads kind of perfectly into my first one. It's a fight, I think, it has similar attributes, like kind of coming back from a break we had. It wasn't the first one back, but arguably the greatest fight to ever happen in the Apex, Dustin Poirier versus Dan Hooker. That was, of course, needs to be noted early on, just an absolute war between those guys, as good as it gets. I think they were originally supposed to headline in San Diego before, you know, COVID hit and we had the break and the readjustment of all these fights. But yeah, that one was obviously, I think, when you talk about Apex fights in general, that was incredible. It was still when, you know, hearing the corners and stuff was like all very fresh, you know, not having the crowd there. And yeah, just hearing those two thud and those shots they landed, just a remarkable fight. I think probably gonna, I don't know, maybe be the first Apex fight to go in the Hall of Fame, I wonder, in the
Fight Wing
that
Hall of Fame
eventually. It could be,
I think it could be that John Anik was on the call for that one. So yep. 2020, we basically alternated events for like the whole year from May when they started on. So I watched that one on my couch, but I agree with you. I was looking at the list of the events. I'm like, I don't really have a story on that one other than everybody else's, which was like, this fight was so, so good. Remember watching it and it was awesome. It was epic.
Yeah, incredible. And I'll kind of just go right off the back of that of another fight result, UFC on ESPN 15. Shayna Dobson scoring one of the biggest upsets in UFC history from a betting line perspective against Maria Agapova. That one just kind of stands out as a result for me as well. Obviously, Agapova was, you know, looking good early in her career. And I mean, it's crazy to think anyone, I guess, with just like a handful of UFC fights can be like an over 1,000 or something close to that betting favorite. But she was, yeah. And Shayna Dobson played huge spoiler that night.
Yeah, beware, you know, the giant favorites when they're not credentialed, right? Mm-hmm. I think we've seen a few of those at the Apex, none that like rip off the top of my head, but certainly in the contender series you see it a lot more too, like a -800 -900 favorite on a fighter that's like 5-1. It's like, really, like, what do we know? Do yeah. they deserve to be that big of a favorite? So if you want me to just keep ripping down the list, I think I'll group these together. But Derek Lewis has had incredible success in the Apex. I don't know what it is. And I wonder if it's more natural to him to fight in that smaller environment. Obviously, he's had some great moments in the big shows for years and on main events. And he's not shy when he's on the microphone, all that sort of stuff. But you know, I think he's fought in Houston a couple of times and it hasn't really gone well with a lot at stake. But yet at the Apex, he's just like, been so, so good. So I think Alexei Olenek was the knockout when he broke the heavyweight record. And I believe that was it.
Yeah,
that was the one. He's had several knockouts. And so that was a more memorable moment when all the events were kind of there on a repeating basis. And I remember I said, there's your knockout. It was a big call because it was like a lot at stake in that fight for Derek to set that record. And then he follows it up by beating Curtis Blaydes as like a 3-1 underdog, maybe even more. Just like Blaydes was just supposed to dominate him, get one takedown, and there you go. And Lewis lands that uppercut, and that was a huge knockout. He knocked out Chris Daukaus in the Apex. I don't know what his record is, but I don't think he's lost at the Apex.
I don't believe so. Yeah, that it's
so. And it might be just those three now that I'm thinking about it, because obviously, when you want to sell tickets, you put Derek Lewis on a card to sell tickets, and he right. does that. So I don't know if we'll see Derek back in the Apex, but. A trio of knockouts, including the one that set the record. Pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I had those written down as well. The Curtis Blaydes one was unbelievable just because he was getting pieced up on the feet. And it was like, Curtis, you don't even need to force this takedown. But we were all, mm-hmm. you know, all the speculation and analysis was like, you just got to work the striking until you go in the takedown. And he was beating Derek up pretty good on the feet. And I think Derek knew that was coming and timed the uppercut perfectly. So yeah, that was a great one for him. I had the one over Daukaus as well, but more so for the post fight when he threw his cup into the crowd and I believe someone caught it. I don't know. I think it's still uncertain if that fella did a shoey out of it or not, but we definitely know he held it and, you know, held it up with pride. There was like a great crowd shot.
That was the one where he had a call. Yeah, I couldn't remember. Yeah. It's a shame he couldn't fight in Edmonton. I hope he gets better. I was talking to Bob Perez on the day of the fight and he was just like, yeah, it's pretty serious. It was good that he didn't gut through it and battle through it. But, yeah, and then in St. Louis this year, you know, to deviate from the Apex just for a minute, but, like, then he moons the crowd. So now he's just, I mean, it's really, you know, I don't know. I don't want to know what's next, but, you know, it'll be one of those moments we can't look away from.
Yeah, well, according to him, I don't know if we believe him, at Media Day before the Edmonton card, he said all that's in the past because he goes to school now with his children and they, you know, the kids are asking him if his balls are
Maybe it's true. Maybe it's true. He's been known to be coy during the week and then completely break from that. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think the Black Beast and Derek Lewis are maybe two different people as well. So I think he gets consumed when he gets in that cage anyways. So
I think you're right.
That was a good one. Okay, for my next one, I want to go back to, again, like early COVID days. And this was we were desperate for stories in those first few events as we kind of went through there. There was more limited media access and things like that. But something that was very unique that happened was Mike Perry telling me in an interview that he was dropping all his corner team and there was going to be just one woman in his corner, his now wife, LaTori, mother of his children and stuff. But at the time, their relationship was pretty new. And he said, you know, she's the only person I'm bringing. She has zero martial arts qualifications. She's never trained. She's never done anything. And people were very confused by this whole move by him. But he went out there and defeated Mickey Gall, had a solid performance. The interactions in the corner career with him and Latorre were good, but I remember that being something, you know, very unique at the time, because we all thought of Mike Perry as a unique character, which he is, but that seemed like a red flag, but it actually worked out pretty well for him.
Yeah, I wonder, like, for you who's covered the sport for a long time, like, was in any way the apex in the early days like a throwback? But the crowds were never that small. That's the thing. So it's like, it was totally unique. But in some ways, I'm just like, man, this is like a throwback to like what I imagine smokers to be.
Right.
You know, like in the 90s when it was just like barely anything was regulated or legal or whatever. And I'm just like, this is, you know, albeit with a commission. Mm-hmm. And like regulatory and TV cameras and that sort of thing. But there were elements of that where it was just, it felt like a warehouse kind of brawl type. Good.
I think the thing that like, I mean, for people who have been watching the sport forever, like you watch how many seasons of The Ultimate Fighter, right? And so you're kind of used to that environment, but on Tough, there's no commentary except for, I think, that one live season, season 15. But usually it's just like all the sounds you kind of hear with just corners and stuff like that. But there's no commentary. So to have this in there and, that was kind of like a fresh feeling mixed with the old, I think, a little bit. But it did take some getting used to. Early on, it was very cool, I thought, with like what you could hear out of the teams and the infight stuff. But now it's like almost become normal at this point that I think the other way.
Sitting in silence during the action, like, you know, when nothing really happens, I don't have to speak every time somebody lands a jab. So, sure. But sometimes it goes on long enough where it's awkward to jump back in. I don't remember which fight it was, but I do remember calling a fight with Paul Felder and Dominic Cruz. And, you know, Cruz is not a talker when he doesn't need to be. He will really study. So the main event starts. And usually after the start of a main event, one of the analysts will jump in and kind of almost give a take on like what they're looking for or like what they've noticed, how they match up with who, almost like, okay, here we go. Fight started. And then they kind of jump in with their thoughts. And for whatever reason, like Felder or Cruz didn't really have anything to say and nothing really happened for like a minute and a half. Yeah. And I remember just thinking like, I'm just like, we're sitting here. It got like, you know, to like 3:30 or 3:40 left in the round. I'm like, I should probably speak again, you know, because nothing really happened. And like everyone was quiet. The crowd was even smaller back then. So I don't remember which particular fight that was, but you get used to just like sitting there in the quiet sometimes and then like jumping back in when things heat up, and it's awkward at first, but you know, to give another fight memory.
Yep.
When I was looking at the list earlier today, Max Holloway and Yair Rodriguez, and I believe it was late 21.
Yeah.
So our fight nights weren't on the road yet. And Max, so our pay-per-views were on the road once per month and that was it.
Yeah.
And so that's like a fight where it's just like, this would be an arena fight. This would sell out Mexico City. It'd probably sell out anywhere in the U.S., anywhere in the world, really, those two guys. And I felt so lucky that I got to call a fight of that caliber at that point, because I was like, usually these guys are pay-per-view guys. Yeah, you're right, I had already called. But I didn't know if I'd ever call a Max Holloway fight in my whole career based on how he was looking when I started in 2017, 2018.
Right.
And so I remember that. I think the VIP tickets for that were like double the normal cost because it was Max and Yair, and it sold out in terms of, you know, the few hundred that they could sell. But it was just like, it was a big fight. And then they lived up to it. Yair, they took the first two rounds. It was just like back and forth war. Usually you don't see that from Max, as we know, like either he's on the offensive end or it's kind of a back and forth technical striking battle. But that one was had a bit of everything. It was awesome.
Yeah, that's a great one. I had that noted as well. UFC Fight Night 197. That was November 13th, 2021. So almost 3 years ago now, which is
great to
think about. And yeah, we got the iconic ambulance photo and Max out after the fight, and you know, had a little moment with the air there. Just two absolute class acts. And you can tell now, like, I was obviously just in Abu Dhabi for 308, and Yair was there as a guest fighter, and you'd hear him talk about Max, and I think I saw them interact, and there's obviously a ton of respect there stemming from that fight. And in that moment too, like, I think a lot of people thought it would maybe be a more dominant fight for Max, but that was in that stage, 2021, you don't know what kind of training these guys were really getting, like with COVID, all that kind of stuff. So some of these fights, you just wonder like how close to perfect these guys were in terms of the preparation. I think some of them were far off, but you mentioned kind of a memorable war from the Apex. Maybe one of the best knockouts to ever happen there. I noted down Yuri Prohazka and Dominic Reyes. That's obviously an insane knockout, spinning back elbow, main event. That was really Yuri Prohazka's arrival statement performance. I know not his debut, but that was an insane one from UFC on ESPN 23 in May 2021.
Yeah, that was a great one. Got to call that one. That happened in the second round or third round. Second round, I think it was.
Yep.
Yeah, Yuri was a guy. What he break in against Volkan in Fight Island, and I just remember thinking, like, gosh, I wish he was in Prague, because we were in Prague like a year before,
right.
And I was like, man, this guy with the record that he already had, he had a ton of experience, and like he just took his time getting to the show. And obviously everybody wanted to see how he followed up against Volkan. And then Dom, I think, was off of his – that was Dom's return after he fought Blachowicz for the title. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So Dom was still, like, right in the upper echelon. And that was a crazy fight. And I remember calling that up kick. Looked like he knocked him out for a minute. And then Yuri revealed after, like, he was out for just a split second. And then he almost, like, woke back up when he's on the ground on top. But that was a great one. That one was vicious, man. That one was, like, point of the elbow, face down. Like, sometimes – I mean, it's good that we watch on the screen sometimes, because when you're that close in that raw of an environment, I was speaking to Dave Shaw last week, and I was talking about, you know, he had his nieces and nephews were in Edmonton to see the show. It was like the first time. I think their oldest was like 14, but the kids were between like 10 and 14. And my son's nine, my older son's nine. I was like, yeah, I thought of making, maybe, you know, bringing him to an APEC show next year or whatever, since I know the flow of it really well. And he's just like, yeah. He's like, I think the arena shows are the better place to take the younger ones, because there's more of a show.
Right.
And if they don't really know what they're looking at, it's pretty raw, which is one of the things that I love about it. Like, the Apex as the most unique venue in sports, and to be able to watch MMA that up close, you know, I know there's a lot of people that miss the big crowds on events like that, but for the lucky few that get to go in there, it's like they all – after the first timers that I talked to, after they're just like, this can't go. This is incredible. It's the most crazy thing that I've ever seen. So even though it's kind of an exclusive club to get in there and watch, it's pretty awesome when you get to do it.
Yeah, I think a couple of the next ones here I have to kind of highlight what you said there about, you know, what can bring out the uniqueness, whether it's in like a, you know, visceral, brutal way because of a knockout or just a moment. So I'll go into this one. A knockout, kind of going off what we just said there. Jordan Leavitt knocking out Matt Wyman with that slam in just 22 seconds at UFC on ESPN 19, December 5th, 2020. That was just gruesome stuff. I mean, Matt Wyman, he was gone, absent for years. He came back, had a fight, and then went into that one. And yeah, that was a real bad slam knockout. And I think just, I mean, I wasn't there for that, but even through television, that was one that really resonated.
Yeah, there's a few that are like that. Corey Sandhagen on Frankie Edgar was one where it was like, holy smokes. Yeah. Like, that one was, I mean, Corey, that'll be on Corey's highlight reel forever. And it's like you hated it at the same time. Even Corey had that reaction. It was just like, I think if you watch it back when he's like waiting to get his hand raised, it's just like, I don't want to do that to Frankie.
Yeah.
You know, like he even says it audibly. So yeah, those up close moments are crazy. You know, another one that was awesome as I'm thinking about these fights, these Vettori's had two epic fights in main events. His fight with Paulo Costa was awesome. His fight with Jared Cannonier was those, amazing.
Yeah, I noted was just like the smashing of Marvin Vettori's skull, whether he was doing it or getting it back in those two fights.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, I guess like the opportunity cost is something that I always wonder about, of like, what would this fight be in a different setting?
Right.
Like, is that a star-making performance for Cannonier versus Vettori? Because this is an epic fight that, like, the crowd's going bananas over in a main event, one of the fights of the year. Mm-hmm. But it won't be listed on any fight of the year list,
right?
Because it's not on the right stage to get that. So sometimes I wonder about that. I'm just like, man, the opportunity cost for these post probably mid-22 is when it was just like everything was open enough. But you know, that's how it goes. And, you know, on the flip side though, like we've seen several fighters like really build their careers in the Apex. And then all of a sudden they're like on the big time, and, you know, like Strickland title shot off of an Apex main event or several.
Mm-hmm.
Jamal Hill, kind of the same thing, right? Title shot after, you know, being the mayor of the Apex, basically. He claimed it was Sweet Dream Stadium. I said, listen, buddy, I'm the mayor of the Apex. I'm here way more than you are. But in terms of in the cage, I get it.
No, that's a good one. You mentioned his name there, so I'll kind of just go off there. Sean Strickland. I don't have a specific fight or whatever, but he basically built the current iteration of what we know Sean Strickland as at the Apex. The in-fight trash talking, which was, I think, a cool product of, you know, the Apex environment. So that was an important one. And yeah, just his rise in there was, I don't know if it would have happened in the same way if he didn't have the opportunities to be as active as he was, you know, step into main events and then obviously, you know, speak the way he did in the fights. I think that really gave him a lot of traction.
Yeah, like Strickland leads the way in that category, but I think it's changed a lot of fighters' careers, both in terms of the amount of opportunities that they have or the opportunities that they get that they wouldn't otherwise get. And that's why a lot of fighters started moving to Vegas in bigger numbers. And before the Apex was going, before 2020, I remember wondering why more fighters didn't live in Las Vegas. And I was like, I get it. It's tough to uproot your lives. Let's say, you know, you're married and you have kids or your whole life is somewhere. I'm just going to move to Vegas on a whim. Although if you're a professional athlete, the company that, you know, is really like your employer in this regard, there's so many resources here for the fighters. And then now with the Apex, there's so many opportunities. That's why some of them just moved here. And it's like, yes, they can look at Dan Ige. I mean, he lived here for a long time anyways, but different circumstance there. But, you know, if they need a fight on a Tuesday of a fight week at the Apex and you're in that pond and around that weight, you stay ready. You might get an extra fight as a UFC fighter, or you might get, that might be how you get your contract. We've seen that a ton of times. So it provides kind of a unique environment for the fighters too.
Definitely. Those first couple of years there was a lot of that. I remember hearing from like multiple managers who live out there. They'd be like, this guy's, you know, just sleeping on my couch for 4 weeks because we think someone's going to pop up in this weight class.
But then and then like Strickland, like when was Strickland's first main event? I mean, it was definitely in the Apex. And it was quite a thing because I don't want to say journeyman in a negative way. I know that fighters throw that around. It's like a negative connotation, but like he had had years on the roster as a welterweight, returns from an injury, from a motorcycle accident. He's fighting up at middleweight. It's like, oh, Sean looks pretty good at middleweight. Hasn't fought in 2 years. And then for him to be in a main event after he would say all the time, I don't care about the belt. I don't care about rankings. I just want to take fights. Give me my money. I'm going to go, whatever. And then all of a sudden he had success with that, his new weight class. Then he lived here. And it's like the fact that he's so outspoken, he became a star. Like he became a star based on the fact that he got put in main events where he probably wouldn't have been put in main events as quickly when it was time to sell tickets to an arena. But he did here, and now all of a sudden he's headlining like major cards. And so it's quite something.
Yeah, that was his run there. In October 31st, 2020 is when he came back from that 2 year layoff. He beat Jack Marshman, which was the one where he had a lot of talk in there. Then
he fought Brendan Allen,
then Krzysztof Jatko, and then got his first main event against Uriah Hall. Won that.
That's right.
Then Jack Hermanson won that, and then that led into the Alex Pereira fight and all that stuff. Where kind of leap
Pereira from there, and then he returns. He fights Cannonier. And then he loses by split decision, fights in back-to-back main events after the 3 weeks off or whatever, beats Imavov, beats Magomedov. And then he's in a title fight again. It's crazy.
No, he that was definitely a huge benefactor to him. So that was a big one. I guess a little more on like the grim side, but this one really just stands out to me because it was the first Apex event I attended, was the first Leon Edwards versus Bilal Muhammad fight. And even just to this day, I know it's like, it sounds bad, but the sound of Bilal Muhammad like screaming and how like much agony and pain he was. If anyone to this day questions the validity of that eye poke, anything like that was one of the worst I've seen, heard in person. And I just remember it so clearly because there was barely anyone in the Apex. That was that early time where, you know, you had to stay the overnight and get COVID tested. Everyone, there's social distancing, all that stuff. So like it was all just very, very raw in that moment. So it really stands out to me just because, again, first time I'd been to the Apex for a fight and having it end like that and just the agony was tough to see.
Yeah, it's like the injuries there are way tougher. I think Estela Nunes broke her arm real bad one time, and it was just like, she's, you know, writhing in pain. Like, what do? You're just sitting there watching. You don't, there's nothing else to do, but it can be very like startling.
Absolutely.
And then like the Joe Pyfer, I wasn't on the call for the Pyfer contender series one when he broke his arm. But yeah, it's a tough sport. It's a tough sport when you're in a big arena. There's like other stuff to kind of look at almost, right? It doesn't feel as real when you're in a smaller room with less people.
For sure. Any other one that you wanted to hit on that's near top of your list?
Let's see. I mean, not that I can think of right now.
Okay.
I'm trying to jog my memory right now. There's been a lot.
I know there has been a lot. I just wrote down as many things as I could. Here's a weird one that I won't forget when Chaz Skelly was left in the octagon.
Jamal Emmers
when he pulled out moments before the walkout, February 20th, 2021. That was very, very unique, and don't know if we've ever seen that before.
Yeah. So I hadn't seen that before. And so we're on the call, and I remember last minute, they just go, Skelly's going to walk first. Like, right, you know, this is like during the feature, right into the leading up to it. And they just go, Skelly's going to walk first. It's like, that's weird. Okay. Don't usually switch up a walk right then, because, you know, if you've ever seen him in the back, I'm sure you have. Mm-hmm. It's like 2 minutes to fight. They kind of walk them there, and they have both fighters standing basically 8 feet apart with their teams, and they go kind of ready to get them out there. So for Skelly to walk first, it's either one, like an operational thing where they just line them up in the wrong place. Okay, whatever. But like, it's in our rehearsals with like the right music, the right, you know, cues and all that sort of stuff. So, or it's like, this guy's not ready. He's not like leaving the locker room. And so then Skelly is in the octagon or whatever. And I'm like, okay, we're definitely past the moment where they'd be counting us 10 in our ear to like the next song. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what's going to, like, usually when you know enough, when like something's off, it's like, all right, what's up? Something's going to happen, especially this. So, and I don't think we had any like day of main event cancellations yet at the Apex, which we have seen way more often than we've seen in arena shows.
Yeah,
it's quite different if you notice that. I said nobody calls in sick to an arena show main event,
right?
But it's happened at the Apex several times, mm-hmm. like 3 or 4 times.
Yep,
which is really unfortunate. But yeah, I remember Skelly just up there, like he's in his kit, like no shirt on, he's just cruising around in the octagon. They greased him all up and everything, and his song just keeps playing. And then we have to like cancel it. And he was just like, I think that was his last UFC appearance, wasn't it? Chaz Skelly?
I think so. I can't remember if he got rebooked for one against someone else later as his retirement fight, or if he just retired right away.
Yeah. Poor guy. I feel like he just had nagging shoulder injuries for years and years and just couldn't get right. And then like Tom Breese had one where he didn't want to fight in the back.
Yep.
That led to his being cut. And then obviously the one in the contender series this year. With Cody Steele, and his opponent just like didn't want to go on fight night. So I can't relate. I'll tell you like a good inside story, not inside story, but Paul Felder, obviously his last fight comes against RDA. Was that November of 2020, right?
It was. I had that written down. UFC fight night 182, took it on 5 days notice.
Yeah. So he takes it on. Who was RDA supposed to fight?
I think it was fight Islam Makhachev. Yeah.
Islam. Yeah. So he's supposed to fight Islam, and 5 days notice. And then I remember my boss texting me, you know, weekend before, and he's just like, it's like they've offered it to Paul was supposed to be on the broadcast.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you know anything about Paul back then, he cut a ton of weight. Like he really had to take his 8 week camp seriously to get down to the right weight, and he was still doing some triathlon training then. I think that's why he was able to say yes. Mm-hmm. And then like I just remember getting the text, and he's just like, he's gonna take it, holy smokes. You know, so he shot the feature really quick. And then I didn't really interact with Paul during the week at all. We were still pretty separate back then. It's 2020. And then I remember the morning of weigh-ins, I walk in and Felder was lying down just behind the backstage area. And he was just so toast. And I had never really seen Paul cut weight. I was in New Zealand when he fought Hooker earlier that year. But that was like an arena show and I was doing the desk. So I wasn't like calling the show and I wasn't like right up in him, but I was on an elevator with Paul in New Zealand that week. And he looked at me like he didn't know who I was. That's like the weight cut, or like he was in battle mode or whatever, but he like looked up, and I think he had a finite amount of energy to be a personality, and he saved it for like media day. And other than that, he was like, go to hell. But he had his hat on. He was dressed up for media day. And I remember he looked at me and it's was almost like we weren't even friends. Like we just met each other or something. And then, so he's lying down to get ready to weigh in for RDA. And he was watching YouTube videos of people drinking Coca-Cola. And so, cause he's, you know, fighters have their ways to cope. And so he would always just love to watch people consume liquids. Mm-hmm. And there's this YouTube channel. It's also weird that this exists. But there's this YouTube channel where a guy pours a 2-liter bottle of Coca-Cola into a big like punch bowl, a big glass punch bowl. And then he drinks it out of the punch bowl.
Okay.
Almost like all of it in one sip. And Felder's just watching those. He's just like, I think he was watching it through FaceTime with his wife, okay, who was like showing him through FaceTime. Really weird. I'm just like, you're almost there, Paul. We'll get you on the scale soon.
Yeah.
And he was good to go. Yeah. I wish that wasn't his last one. I wish he was able to fight in a big arena, but
for sure that would have been a proper send off. But yeah, I remember that whole week too. That was crazy. It was a story going from the commentary booth into the main event. And yeah, I remember, I think that's when he debuted the mustache too, or like the Ross version of
yeah,
the
mustache. He was mustache. That was November. Yep. So it was the Movember mustache.
Well, I guess in the vein of commentary related stuff, I also noted here Laura Sanko making her commentary debut, the first female UFC color commentator in the modern era. That was February 2023. So yeah, that was kind of a big moment that happened there. And I believe you were on the team with her, right, for that first one?
No, I think she was with Gooden and Bisping for the first one. She'll be on the call with us this weekend. So she helped celebrate 100.
Yep.
And you know, well deserved. I mean, it was it's a great platform for a lot of people, but it's one of those things too where it's like we can take chances because it's not in front of the world. So it's not like we're, you know, so you can try different things and, you know, whatever. Not that like we weren't going to try Laura if we stayed in arenas the whole time. I'm not saying that, but it's just like, it's a great place for fighters to build their resumes and for everybody else, like behind the scenes crew to get reps on a show. Like they're not going to be controlling graphics or cameras at Madison Square Garden or on International Fight Week or these big arena shows, but in the Apex, they can get a lot of reps and we can really like kind of build the team even more and always.
Yeah. I think I saw Zach Candido speak on that in one of the interviews he did leading up to Noche UFC, where there was obviously a lot of a focus on kind of the background and the behind the scenes, saying just how helpful like Road to the UFC and Contender Series also are in that regard and kind of grooming talent where there's less pressure and more freedom to kind of experiment. So it seems like that is paying off and kind of building the UFC broadcast team as a whole.
Yeah. And it's like, we're a company that's still growing rapidly. And so it shouldn't be viewed by anybody as like, oh, this person's coming to take my spot. It's like, we're only growing. Mm-hmm. So when you grow and you want to do more, you need more. Like if an NHL team played 50 games and now they're playing 82 games, you need more staff to like do it all. The same way that every sport wants to grow. So we're growing more. And so we've added Road to UFC and therein lies opportunities for a lot of people to grow their careers. It's awesome.
No doubt. Okay, only a few more minutes here. I pretty much touched on everything I had on my list. The only one not yet was Anderson Silva having his final UFC.
Yeah, that was another one when I was looking at the list. I was like, that's crazy he had to retire from the UFC anyways. In that setting, Halloween night, I remember like writing to the Spider on Halloween and all that sort of stuff. So that was cool. But yeah, unfortunate that he, you know, obviously that he lost. And unfortunate that he had to end his career in that environment, because we've seen our production team has really stepped up when people do retire. Michelle Watterson Gomez, Robbie Lawler, Korean Zombie. Like we've prepared for it in a way that really punctuates the moment for fans. And so I wish some of those guys were able to get that treatment in the same way.
Yeah, definitely. A little circumstantial with that one. Daniel Cormier in the same vein, even though his was on a pay-per-view, so wasn't qualifying him in this specific conversation. Yeah, but yeah, he fits the same description on that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, just two last things before I let you go. We kind of hit on it a little bit throughout as you talk, some of the calls you made. I know I didn't prepare you for this specifically, but when someone asks you, like, what's your favorite call, Apex or not, what stands out to you?
Oh, Apex or not?
You could stick with just the Apex if you want, but I don't know if maybe
just Apex. I think the two are the ones that I spoke about, the Calvin Kattar moment at the end of that round. I like my calls to be the same reaction that fans have when they're on their couch. Like to me, it shouldn't be this rehearsed soliloquy or written thing. It should kind of be what you say when you watch something like that. Mm-hmm. So the Cater one was cool. This has been missing in my life. And then, you know, Derek Lewis, when he sets the knockout record, as far as Apex ones go. I might have had some others in there. I used to try to keep track of my great moments, and now I'm just like, you know.
It's too much.
As in everything in life, just like the fighters, we're always just trying to chase the next great moment. So once it's there, it's cool. I've really tried to make each event as special as it can be, Apex or not. That's something I did this year. When they got monotonous, I was getting a bad headspace about it. And so this year I moved out of Las Vegas. So I don't live in Las Vegas anymore. So now when I come back, they already feel better to me because I'll go out to dinner with the crew. Whereas before, when I live here, it's just, it's at home. Yeah. And it's like, you know, when you have a wife and kids, it's tough to like go out and do all these other things. Especially, I'm not going to go down to the strip. I'm not going to go out to dinner as readily as I do now, where it's like, no, team building time. I had two dinners with Felder in Vegas the last time we were here, and he's probably getting into town tonight and whoever else is around. And even just taking the shuttle with, like, you know, Dan Helly and Alan Joban or Michael Chiesa from like the hotel to the Apex makes it feel like more of a team thing than it was in the past.
And then just last thing, as you look ahead to 2025, I know you got a few shows left. Do you have any goals, like career-wise, that you're kind of setting it for yourself in terms of commentary, or do you just already have, you know, such a great spot, you're just trying to produce the best stuff possible?
Yeah, like we have, you know, there's like goal setting in terms of like, I don't know if you guys have it at MMA Junkie, like, do you have like career evaluations and goal setting and that sort of thing?
Yeah,
right?
Like, they sometimes make us fill some stuff out like at right. The end of every year or whatever. So I don't know how much
that
should read
goals,
it.
I think having goals is a smart thing. But in my case, I've learned to like settle and be like, you know how many people would love to have the job that I have? Like, it's incredible. And so I feel so lucky to do what I do. And when work is hard or, you know, long, or I'm on weekend 5 of 6 in a row right now. That's quite a lot in terms of trips to the airport and different spots. But at the same time, like when I get there, this is joyful work. It's amazing that I get to do this and call it a living. And then on the other side is like, what would my goals be? People be like, oh, so what's your goal? Call a pay-per-view. And I'm like, well, how does that sound to you? Like how does it sound? I know it's not quite the same as a backup quarterback, but like if the backup quarterback is in the media just saying, I really want to start, I'd love to start, that doesn't create great vibes in the locker room. So it's like our team is set up the way that it's set up. And it's like, I have really enjoyed being involved in some of the bigger events this year. I was doing desk, you know, pre-show, post-show for UFC 300, International Fight Week, Sphere, mm-hmm. In Abu Dhabi. I was in Bristol. I'll be at MSG working with ESPN. So I'm like super, super grateful for that. And that wasn't really like a goal, but it was something where I was just like, I'd love to be involved in our biggest events. Whereas in the past few years, I haven't been. Okay. This year, I have been more so. So I guess like hope that continues, right? Hope to like to contribute to the team in any way I can, whether it's our smaller events or our biggest events. And then this is the second year that I'm calling the big ESPN fight night at the end of the year, the Stuart Scott Memorial Show for the V Foundation. That was something last year where when I got that assignment, I was like, this is cool. This is like a tangible step up where a John Anik always did that in the past. And now they're giving it to me. That means something to me. And then the last point about the Apex is that maybe it offered me the chance to be on ESPN broadcasts quicker than it would have in the past, because there was no other sports inventory on in 2020. And in 2019, the first year of our ESPN deal, when it was a big ESPN show, John did it. Anik had to do it. That was something that they were sticking with. I don't know how soon they would have relaxed that. I imagine they would have at some point, but 2020 kind of broke that barrier where it's just like, okay, just because it's on ESPN, Brendan can do it too. And so that's led to some big opportunities for me as we've gone forward. Cheeto and Dom in San Diego was a big ESPN August show. It was a lot of fun, kind of an elevated fight night. So I've been proven to be able to like handle those and thrive in those situations. So it's been good. On we go, man. In 2025, there's some new project that'll pop up that I'm not thinking about that'll be great to add to my repertoire. We'll see what it is.
Definitely. Well, every opportunity is deserved and earned, man. You are one of the best at what you do on play-by-play. So I very much appreciate you coming on here and reminiscing a little bit about these Apex events. And I'm sure I will have you on the show many more times in the future as we continue to roll here at the Bonfire. So thank you so much, Brendan. Yeah. Appreciate your time. And I'll be right back to wrap this thing up.
Happy to. Good luck on the podcast, Mike. Great job.
And that does it for another episode of The Bonfire. Thank you so much to Brendan Fitzgerald for his time and joining the show. Some great insights there. A nice stroll down memory lane. Those were some of our favorite Apex moments. You tell me in the comments, wherever you want to leave a reaction, what your favorite or most memorable Apex moment was. There's been a lot of them, probably more we could have even touched on, but I thought we hit all the biggest ones there outside of some of the pay-per-view fights, of course, that don't really count towards the conversation we had. So hope you all enjoyed. Thank you so much. Please remember to show your support however you can, and we will see you back here next week. UFC 309 fight week, a huge one. The return of Jon Jones, the fight for Stipe Miocic finally happening. Madison Square Garden, New York. I will be there covering that fight week. But before things get crazy, we'll be back with another episode of The Bonfire. See you all then.